It certainly is big, but I don't think anybody could describe it as being beautiful. It has a very harsh reality to it.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, we catch up with Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal, a Democrat from the 1st District, in office since 1989. Well, President Trump has signed his domestic agenda package, also known as the Big Beautiful Bill. Republicans are cheering the tax breaks, but Democrats are warning of a coming cliff for their states. A key question is, when will voters notice? For more on the bill and its impacts, I spoke with Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal, the ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee. Okay, here's our conversation.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
So, you know, we're speaking after President Trump signed his domestic agenda package. The last time you and I talked, it hadn't gotten through the House yet. So now that we're past the bill becoming law and we know what it includes, what are your top line thoughts on the package?
Well, it certainly is big, but I don't think anybody could describe it as being beautiful. It has a very harsh reality to it. It was very cleverly scheduled so that the benefits for high-income taxpayers kick in immediately. But the hits on our hospitals and on Medicaid, they will not come until after the 2026 midterm elections. So that was a bit of chicanery as applied to the legislative process. But the reality is that this is going to have a huge impact on our hospitals, our Medicaid recipients. And when you look at the tax distribution tables, people at the top are going to do quite well.
Now, process-wise, we know it got through the House by one vote. Was that of any surprise to you?
Not really. I think that there's an enforcement mechanism in the Republican Party today that has little to do with the function of legislative life and or the ability or power of the Speaker of the House to muscle through legislation. And it all comes down to the whip count, which is based on what Donald Trump says that day. I think Republicans are frightened of a primary, and the result is that they go along even when they do not like what they have to vote for. And as you know, this week, the president has already threatened primaries against senators who might oppose his cuts to spending, which are arbitrarily proposed and may well, I hope, be defeated on the floor later in the week on the Senate side. So once again, you can't overstate the ability of this president to intimidate Republican Party members into doing what he wants, even when they know, as is the case with tariffs, that it's mistaken policy.
So I want to get back to the quote unquote big, beautiful bill in a minute. But since you've raised it and it's very timely, this rescissions package that you were talking about, which was sent over at the president's behest to the Senate, includes clawing back a bunch of already approved funding. I mean, obviously, you've been in Congress for a long time. How unusual is this?
It's very unusual. You'd almost have to go back to the impoundment argument that Richard Nixon had with Congress at the time, and he decided to seek out a court case after he proposed a freeze on federal spending as he proposed the priorities, which is not the function of the president. They outline priorities, but it's members of Congress who determine priorities and subsequently implement them. So in the case of President Nixon, he sought a test case with the Supreme Court, and he lost. And time and again, even with the line item veto implementation, when Bill Clinton used it, Republicans howled. And that was subsequently shot down in the federal courts as well. And I bring that up because I still hope that, if this were to prevail later in the week in the U.S. Senate, that there would be a court case that would challenge this reality. The president does not have this arbitrary authority to determine priorities in spending after they, in fact, have been legislated through the appropriate branch of government, the Congress.
Do you think there's any long-term damage being done to your branch of government's ability to be an independent, you know, voice at the table?
Every hour. I think that James Madison forewarned that this could happen. That's why it was noted that in a constitutional outline, Congress is mentioned as the first branch of government. Recall that this dates back to King John at Runnymede in 1215, and that is that the legislative function ought to rest in the hands of those who are popularly elected, but at the same time to oversee an executive. 250 years next July, I think, helped to ascertain that. The idea was that we might create a president, but we in fact would not create a king in our constitutional system. And I think that it's a reminder always, as you know, I've had a long history in the as faculty member at UMass and other institutions. And one of the things that I always remind students of is that presidents of the United States, they have a role for sure, but members of Congress do not serve under presidents of the United States. They, in fact, serve with presidents of the United States. But more importantly, the fundamental role of Congress is oversight of the executive.
Now, what do you think the result of this will be? Because presumably, you know, President Trump is in his second and, as the Constitution says, last term. And so, you know, Congress and members you serve with are presumably going to be there after he's gone. Do you think that there's any putting back the pieces from what we've seen so far with, you know, the abdication of the role to many degrees? Does the executive just, I guess what I'm asking is, will the executive just stay, you know, sort of more powerful than designed even after Trump is gone?
Well, we've had many rhythms to that description that you've just offered. And we have from time to time, I think, given executives too much authority during the New Deal. As you know, that came up time and again. Roosevelt, I think, was required to act with great speed and deliberation. And then it subsided. Republicans, including Eisenhower, they accepted the tenets of the New Deal, but they also took the position that there ought to be a more reserved approach, for example, to foreign interventions. And that seemed to prevail, but presidential power began to grow again. And Arthur Schlesinger, as you know, outlined that in his superb book, The Imperial Presidency. And now I think we're back to a better balance, or an argument about a better balance. The fear I have, Ian, on a very candid basis, is that I think that Donald Trump may be gone in 2.5 years or 3 years, but I don't think Trumpism is going to go away. I think that social media inflates this conflict. I think it highlights the conversation in terms of what we disagree about, but it also is done in a very unprofessional manner. I think that the attention economy is in front of us all of the time. And an example I would use is, but 3 weeks ago, we were talking about bombing Iran. 2 weeks later, all we were talking about was the big, beautiful bill. This week, we're talking about tariffs. And I think that the attention span certainly has shortened for those of us to try to follow it every day, but not to miss the point that I think it also allows in the modern vernacular for presidential excesses not to be properly reviewed.
And Congressman Neal, I want to get back now to the quote unquote big, beautiful bill, this giant domestic package that President Trump was able to get through. We talked about the House vote, which was one vote. The Senate, there was some discussion about some senators who might have some misgivings, but ultimately it sailed through that chamber as well. Did that part of the vote surprise you?
It did. What really just surprised me more so, though, was the irony of the fact that there were those in the U.S. Senate who voted for it and then later described it as a lousy bill. And I think that whatever they were able to extract in the negotiation is understandable, but at the same time, you wonder what sort of moral veracity existed for that sort of a plan. I mean, Alaska's hospitals are going to take a pretty good hit on this. Alaska is a highly intense state when it comes to Medicaid recipients. And I think that no matter what the senator was able to extract during the negotiations, it will not offset the cuts that are coming to Medicaid and Medicare down the road.
So speaking of which, I mean, what will be the impacts on healthcare services in the first district, in your district?
It's considerable. I believe there are 300,000 citizens of the first congressional district who receive a Medicaid or Medicare benefit. And more importantly, a lot of people don't understand how significant Medicaid and Medicare are in the formula as to how we finance our hospital system, which in many cases in Massachusetts is arguably one of the best in the world. So if you look at Bay State Medical Center, for example, which is the largest employer in Western Massachusetts, I think they are north of 12,000 employees. And you consider that their Medicaid, Medicare balance is about 67% of revenue. So if you go 40 miles to the east at UMass Memorial, they employ about 14,000 people, and they have roughly the same balance. But if you look at Holyoke Hospital, or you look at the Mercy Hospital in Springfield, and I'm sure it's true of the hospitals in the Berkshires as well, that their formula is considerably higher than the 67% that I've just described. And I think that you could argue that it would be in the high 70s for the two institutions I've mentioned. What you want to take a look at here is on the policy side, that in our Massachusetts system, Boston has scale, so they have more private pay. Less so is the case in central and western Massachusetts, or for that matter on Cape Cod or South Coast as well. And I think that that needs to be better understood. That's a big hit when you consider that Bay State Medical Center is a considerable employer, first-class health care as well, but like the other hospitals I've just described, and they really are well done, they rely heavily on the Medicare-Medicaid reimbursement fees.
Now, Governor Healey has said that Massachusetts cannot absorb the funding impacts on the state that are coming from this package. So what kind of conversations are happening between your office, the delegation, and the governor about where the state goes from here?
Well, I've talked to the governor a number of times on this, and she understands it entirely. And here's the challenge. I mean, because the formula with Medicaid, not Medicare, the formula with Medicaid is a shared proportion, meaning that about half of the Medicaid dollars come from the state and about half come from the federal government. And that's, I think, foremost in this debate, meaning that when these cuts take place on the federal side, it'll be very difficult, if not impossible, for the states then to compensate for those cuts. This has a rural emphasis to it, for sure, because many red states have rural hospitals that are going to, I think, disproportionately be impacted by these cuts. The argument that the governor has made time and again is that Massachusetts cannot supplement this expenditure, and I think that is the grim reality of what we will be facing. All, by the way, to justify tax cuts, which I hope we'll have a chance to discuss as well.
Well, let's go right there. Obviously, you are an important cog in the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee. And as you say, independent analysts have shown that this package will reorient a lot of the wealth toward the top. What can you tell us about the tables?
Well, I think, first of all, we should reject the theology that became very popular during the Reagan years, that tax cuts pay for themselves. There's not a mainstream economist that will abide that argument. In addition, then we moved in the direction of the notion that it would generate higher growth. The Joint Committee on Taxation, the Congressional Budget Office, which is comprised not of Democrats or Republicans or libertarians or socialists or whatever the description, these individuals are the referees. They are professionals. Everything in their lives is based on their reputation. They have indicated that this at most will generate 1% addition in growth. Hardly a justification for that growth paying for these tax cuts. So let me give you a number from the distribution tables, and I would challenge my Republican colleagues to dispute this. If you earn $1 million this year, you are likely to see a $96,000 tax break in the reporting season next April. If you earned under $50,000 in this cycle, you are going to receive, as you report it next year, about 68 cents a day. And you're going to watch and witness as the Republican Party, astonishingly enough, they have raised the debt ceiling by $5 trillion. Can you imagine what the reaction would be if Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, or Joe Biden came back and said, we want to raise the debt ceiling to borrow up to $5 trillion over the next 10 years. I wonder if you look back at Ronald Reagan, who is often seen as an iconic figure by younger, so a bit older Republicans, I guess that would be a better description. The idea that Reagan would have proposed a $5 trillion increase in the debt ceiling to borrow the money to pay for the tax cuts is beyond imagination. And here's another very gleaming fact. In 2017, the Republican Party voted to borrow $2.3 trillion for tax cuts. So they're borrowing the money for tax cuts, and they're arguing that this is going to generate additional economic growth, and you can't find mainstream economists who would support any of it.
So what do you make of that evolution? I've been asking everybody on this show. I mean, it's, as you say, it's traditional sort of GOP orthodoxy that they oppose adding to the debt and the deficit. And this bill is one of the biggest additions to that, as you say, in memory in Congress. So, I mean, how do you approach making that case to voters and to people paying attention to Congress?
Well, I think it's Donald Trump's personality. Whatever he says goes. It says he calls it. I mean, I think his next assault, as we're witnessing, is going to be on the Federal Reserve Board. And as he challenges and ridicules Jay Powell, who was a Republican, I think has done a fine job. But most importantly, it's keeping the Federal Reserve Board independent. We'll be meeting with a regional governor of the Fed in just the next few days. And I'm going to reiterate my position that the Fed needs to maintain its legislative function, and that deals with prices and employment. And the worrisome part of this argument, I think, for all of us is that we don't want Powell intimidated. And the reason he's being intimidated and ridiculed, as I noted, is because what the president wants is lower borrowing costs to argue that his tax bill is bringing down the size of the federal debt. There's no evidence to support that conclusion, but that's why he wants a change in the head of the Federal Reserve Board.
Hmm. What would you say to the argument that this is what voters wanted? You know, they gave Republicans control of Congress and they gave the White House back to Trump. And so even though the bill is unpopular, when it really counted in November, voters went a different way.
Well, I think it highlights just the proximity, though, of the election. And despite what the president says about his overwhelming mandate, he won by 1.4%. And I think in the House, there's a 3-vote margin. In the Senate, in the House, there's about a 4-vote margin. And in the Senate, there's a 3-vote margin. And I think that if we had taken up the immigration issue a bit earlier, I think that we would have maintained a majority in the House and probably would have maintained a majority in the Senate as well. So this argument that they have a free hand to do whatever they want is not met by the election result.
What do you say to the GOP argument in this package that it was really about rooting out fraud, you know, kind of continuing the theme from DOGE that these social service programs are riddled by misuse?
So let's go to the facts once again. Elon Musk said that he was going to weed out $2 trillion worth of fraud at the federal level. It's closer to about $80 billion. And in reality terms, what that means is that they didn't find all the fraud they said they were going to, for sure. And if there is fraud, Ian, that's for the United States Attorney's offices. They should report it and prosecute it. But as long as I've been in government, the easiest position for those who don't like government to say is, when asked about cuts, they always give that vague reference, waste, fraud, and abuse. Well, tell us where it all is. And certainly, it's not enough to justify borrowing $5 trillion for tax cuts.
Congressman Neal, you know, as you zoom out a little bit from the quote-unquote big, beautiful bill, what's next on your to-do list for this congressional term? I was talking to one very smart analyst on this show who said this is pretty much it for Congress now that this big, beautiful bill is passed.
It is, but I also think that we now have a requirement to claw back congressional authority as it relates to the implementation of tariffs. Recall that tariffs are a tax, and the chaos that is coming from these tariff proposals, where they're announced at 9 in the morning, there's a retreat at 2, a cancellation at 7, is hardly the way to conduct. Hardly the way to conduct international affairs. The president said that he was going to solve the Ukraine-Russian war in one day. The president said that there were going to be 90 trade deals in 90 days. By the way, there are 2, and we don't even know what the details are with the UK and Vietnam. He's also threatening tariffs on Brazil for the only reason that he doesn't like the presidential outcome. That in and of itself is bad policy. It's bad relations, and we are driving away NATO. We are driving away our allies across the globe. I was the lead negotiator on USMCA. 195 Democrats voted for USMCA. 194 Republicans voted for USMCA. It was the largest trade agreement in the history of the world. And next year, it was subject to review anyway. So Canada has been a hard and fast and good ally of ours, and the president is arbitrarily proposing a 30% increase. And here's the kicker. We run a surplus with Canada, but for oil. And we run a trade surplus with Brazil. And these threats to our global allies and our retrenchment as it relates to being a leader in international affairs, where the president has now come to conclude that it's necessary to give more aid to Ukraine with the Patriot missile system, but he's trying to cover the politics of it by saying that NATO's going to pay for it. I think that the reality here is that these changes that take place every moment of the day in policy, they make it very difficult for our friends and allies across the globe to take us seriously.
And so just for listeners, the USMCA was the Mexico-Canada agreement that came after NAFTA. So, and this spring, actually, Governor Healey hosted the Northeast governors and the Canadian premiers for kind of a trade summit in Boston to talk about how the region should be approaching this time of uncertainty, as you've been mentioning. So do you think that, you know, Massachusetts has to carve out its own path with respect to trade and dealing with Canada that's separate from the way that Trump is dealing with Canada?
Well, that's difficult, as you know, because there are federal standards that relate to international trade agreements, and they have to be confirmed by the Congress of the United States. But Massachusetts, because of our geography, we're much dependent on Canada, and Canada is much dependent on Massachusetts. So I was pleased with what the governor did. And at the same time, I've been in contact with premierships in Canada. I've spoken with them. I've tried to reassure them that we want to review USMCA as the agreement calls for next year. That's the appropriate way to keep confidence from our allies. And I always recall the description of Jack Kennedy when he said, we might share a common border, but we also share a common friendship.
Let me go to a couple of other things. You know, given the flooding in Texas the other day, there's been a lot of debate and discussion about whether federal cuts may have limited the warnings that residents got and the response time. What's your view of that?
Well, there's the immediate deniability that comes from the White House, even after they said they were going to eliminate FEMA. Well, they've walked that back pretty carefully.
Yeah, as soon as FEMA had to do something in response to a tragedy, you didn't hear a lot about getting rid of it anymore.
That's exactly right. And then if you recall, during the last presidential campaign, when candidate Trump traveled to North Carolina and said only Democrats were having assistance from FEMA, that was baloney. And I think that FEMA has proved its worth time and again. All 50 states depend on it because of what we call the national principle. And the national principle says when there's a tragedy in one part of our country, we all come to the assistance of members of the American family. I know that FEMA did a very good job here in the Pioneer Valley after the tornado that hit eight communities here. And
2011,
they were on the ground. They were on the ground. They were responsive. And those homeowners, I always use as an example in East Forest Park, they might have lived in trailers for 2 years, but I've got to tell you, you drive through there now and you can see the worth of what was accomplished.
I want to talk a little politics with you. The other day, you and a bunch of Western Massachusetts lawmakers endorsed Ed Markey for re-election to the Senate. How come you're with Ed?
Well, I've known Eddie for a long time. We've been friends, not just in terms of Washington talk, but we've had similar careers. We've known each other for a long, long period of time, and I think Eddie's been very effective, and I think his leadership on some key issues has been essential. And there's also something to be said, I think, for senatorial longevity. I think that if we retain or get back, if we get back the House and then go on to win the Senate, I think he'll be in a very key position for us. And I think over the years that Eddie has exercised very good judgment. And another, on a personal note, he's not malicious. I mean, he's happy to parry back and forth with a critic. But the idea that there's anything mean about Eddie Markey, simply doesn't merit even conversation.
So this is slightly indelicate, but, you know, he is going to be 80 at the time of the next election, and it's a 6-year term. And I think there are some questions about age percolating around the Democratic Party after what happened in 2024. So do you think he can do it for 6 more years?
Sure. And I used to play basketball with him, and I knew he was going to go to the Senate because he never passed the ball. But he was always in pretty good shape then, and he is now. I talked to him with great regularity. And I think that, look, if there's a problem, then you can outline it. But to my knowledge, nobody has challenged him on that basis.
So where do you play on the court? Are you a point guard?
Oh, yeah. And I got to tell you, I knew I'd be the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee because I actually knew how to pass the ball.
Is there any room for Congressman Neal in the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, or were you more on the assist than the scoring?
Well, you need this very important consideration. My name is in the Hall of Fame, and that's because I helped to secure $6 million
for
the Hall of Fame. So my name is there, believe me, and staff carefully guards it.
separate from the Senate race, do you subscribe to the idea that your party, the Democrats, are favored in the midterms, which is usually what happens halfway through the presidential term, or are things just too mixed up these days?
Well, your description is correct. Things are mixed up, and there's greater volatility in the election cycle. But this is a very good time, Ian, for people to assess what happened in the last round of federal elections, because now the facts begin to make their way to the surface. And I think that as we review those facts, we're mindful of the idea that the historic norm is that Democrats should pick up about 26 seats. Now, I want to qualify that, again, based upon the fact that the pollsters have been wrong in the last 3 elections in terms of margins as well as who was going to win what. So they've made these predictions, and the two political parties have come up a bit short. But I think that there's also a fatigue that is settling in with Donald Trump, and I think that a lot of people feel as though Republicans are not asking any questions about the president's policies. So my guess is that the tariffs, the chaos, and the opportunity for people to make their position known probably will result in a greater turnout of Democrats next year than is usual.
We always love spending all this time with Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal, a Democrat from the 1st District, and he's been in office since 1989. Congressman Neal, thank you as ever, and we look forward to hearing your voice on these airwaves again.
Great to be with you, Ian. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.